The Lord be with you.
And with thy spirit.
Let us pray. Almighty God, please give your servant grace to speak and grace to those who listen, that we may all together be edified and may glorify your name. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
I get to share with you today an idea that really excites me, and which I think also very much excited the Inklings, and that is the idea of the music of the spheres. And so I want to start by reading to you from one of the Inklings, C.S. Lewis. This is from his Chronicles of Narnia. And some of you will already be familiar with the story of Narnia's creation as it's told in The Magician's Nephew. But if you're not familiar with the story, Diggory and Polly and the evil witch, Jadis, and Uncle Andrew and a London cabbie and his horse have all together been stranded in Narnia before it is Narnia. They find themselves in an empty black space that is nothing. "This is not Charn," came the witch's voice. "This is an empty world. This is nothing." And really, it was uncommonly like nothing. There were no stars. It was so dark that they couldn't see one another at all, and it made no difference whether you kept your eyes shut or open. Under their feet, there was a cool, flat something which might have been earth and was certainly not grass or wood. The air was cold and dry, and there was no wind. And jumping ahead, in the darkness, something was happening at last. A voice had begun to sing. It was very far away, and Diggory found it hard to decide from what direction it was coming. Sometimes it seemed to come from all directions at once. Sometimes he almost thought it was coming out of the earth beneath them. Its lower notes were deep enough to be the voice of the earth herself. There were no words. There was hardly even a tune. But it was beyond comparison the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful that he could hardly bear it. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by the other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead all at once was blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently, one by one, as they do on a summer evening. One moment, there had been nothing but darkness. Next moment, 1,000,000 points of light leaped out. Single stars, constellations, and planets, brighter and bigger than any in our world. There were no clouds. The new stars and the new voices began at exactly the same time. If you had seen and heard it, as Diggory did, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves which were singing, and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them sing. Now keep that tucked away in the back of your mind as I read another creation account that we heard a little bit of yesterday from another of the Inklings, J.R.R. Tolkien. This is from the Silmarillion. "There was Eru, the one, who in Arda is called Ilúvatar. And he made first the Ainur, the holy ones, that were the offspring of his thought. And they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music, and they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, or but a few together, while the rest hearkened, for each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came, and in the understanding of their brethren they grew but slowly. And it came to pass that Ilúvatar called together all of the Ainur and declared to them a mighty theme, unfolding to them things greater and far more wonderful than he had yet revealed. And the glory of its beginning and the splendor of its end amazed the Ainur, so that they bowed before Ilúvatar and were silent. Then Ilúvatar said to them, 'Of the theme that I have declared to you, I will now that ye make in harmony together a great music. And since I have kindled you with a flame imperishable, ye shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. Then the voices of the Ainur, like unto harps and lutes and pipes and trumpets and viols and organs, and like unto countless choirs singing with words, began to fashion the theme of Ilúvatar to a great music. And a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies woven in harmony that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights. And the places of the dwelling of Ilúvatar were filled to overflowing. And the music and the echo of the music went out into the void, and it was not void. So here you have two creation accounts by two different inklings, both of which have a very common thread, a very obvious common thread, and that is that in both, the vehicle of creation is music itself. And in both, you will find that the cosmos itself, the created world, is a thing which makes music. Later in the Silmarillion account, Ilúvatar reveals to the Ainur that their song has been made a reality, that their song has formed creation itself. Now, what you might not know is that the Inklings are, in fact, participating in a much older line of thought than just themselves. They have not come up with this idea for the first time. This is a very, very old idea, which has occurred to writers and to creators again and again throughout history. It is, in fact, an idea that goes back to the Middle Ages, further back to the early Christian authors, even further back to the Greeks, and arguably, and this is what really excites me, even back to the scriptures itself. And so I would like to begin with the scriptures and with the idea that the cosmos itself, the universe itself, is musical in the eyes of God. I'd like to read from the book of Job. You'll recall that Job, who is suffering, calls God to account for his suffering and says, I would speak with God and I would have him explain himself. And in the words of Forrest Gump, well, right about then, God showed up. And God speaks to Job from the whirlwind and says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Now listen closely to this sentence. Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? At the birth of the world, in the poetry of Job, the stars were singing. Now, if you were to rifle through your brain, I'm sure that you could come up with any number of passages from elsewhere in the scriptures, the Psalms, and other places, where creation itself is described as singing to the Lord, and bits of creation that we do not normally think of as singing or making music. In Psalm 65, the pastures are clothed with flocks. The valleys also are covered with grain. They shout for joy. They also sing. Or in Isaiah, sing, O heavens, be joyful, O earth, and break out in singing, O mountains, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have mercy on his afflicted. And this is only scratching the surface. If you spend much time with the Psalms, you will see again and again that the cosmos itself is depicted as a musical thing, making music to the Lord. So this is an old idea that represents, if you will, a continuum, something that truth is not new. Truth is not, in that sense, discovered by someone. But people constantly re-encounter truth. And so we're going to visit a few places along the way in this trajectory, from the scriptures to the Greeks to the medievals, where this idea has reoccurred to someone, where someone has encountered the truth again. The first instance that we have in this of history, someone writing about this idea, if we're going to leave aside for a moment the book of Job, which is arguably the oldest book of the Bible, would be Pythagoras the Greek, about 600 years before Christ. Through him, Plato inherited this idea 400 years before Jesus, and after Jesus, the early Christian fathers took it up. You can find that Augustine talks about this in his treatise De Musica. A Roman music theorist named Boethius wrote about it in the late 400s and early 500s, and Boethius was such an important thinker and such an important writer when it came to music theory that his treatise, De Institutione Musicia, dominated medieval thinking about music for the next 1,000 years. It came down to Dante. You can find this in Dante's Divine Comedy. It came down to Shakespeare. If you know Shakespeare's plays well, you will find that in them the cosmos sings. And it even came down to Johannes Kepler. That's right, the astronomer who was concerned to work out a theory in which the sun is at the center of the solar system. Nonetheless, this man on the cusp of modernity, working out a modern scientific theory, was very concerned to show that the cosmos is musical and that the planets sing polyphony to God. And so if you open up his Harmonies of the World, you will find in the back of it entire scores, motets, where he composes out the music of the planets. Let's visit one point along this trajectory in England. This is John Dryden, the poet laureate of England, who lived from 1631 to 1700. And he wrote a piece called A Song for St. Cecilia's Day. St. Cecilia is, of course, the patron saint of music, and so it's understandable that Dryden, writing an ode to her, would spend a lot of time talking about the phenomenon of music itself. And what he says is, "From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began, when nature underneath a heap of jarring atoms lay and could not heave her head. The tuneful voice was heard from high, 'Arise, ye more than dead.' Then cold and hot and moist and dry in order to their stations leap and music's power obey. From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. From harmony to harmony, through all the compass of the notes it ran, the diapason closing full in man." Diapason is not a word that we use in common parlance anymore, and it's a word that has borne a number of different meanings in its life. I think that what Dryden means by it here is the whole spectrum of pleasant sounds. So all pleasing sounds are consummated in man, the pinnacle of creation. Through all the compass of the notes it ran, the diapason closing full in man. That's the creation with music as its vehicle. There's also an eschaton, an end of times, with music as its vehicle. Dryden writes, "As from the power of sacred lays the spheres began to move and sung the great creator's praise to all the blessed above, so when the last and dreadful hour this crumbling pageant shall devour, the trumpet shall be heard on high, the dead shall live, the living die, and music shall untune the sky." And I would like to play for you now an excerpt of this poem as it is set to music by George Frederick Handel, who lived about 40 years after Dryden. He set it to music, and I'm going to play for you the excerpt, "From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. From harmony to harmony, through all the compass of the notes it ran, the diapason closing full in man." And I would invite you to listen to two examples of how Handel depicts the meaning of the poetry in the music. One most obvious is that when it says "from harmony," he of course has the choir sing not a unison note, but harmony. And then the other is that when he gets to the text, "through all the compass of the notes it ran," he has the choir depict this through running scales. "Through all the compass of the notes it ran." So here we go. Here's George Frederick Handel, and I'm going to have to stop it halfway through, but this will be about 4 minutes. Comes the compass of the notes. have to interrupt Handel, sadly, in the middle of his polemic, which always kills me. But we have a lot of great music to get to. So let's visit another great poet talking about this same idea, the idea that music was the vehicle of creation. John Milton, who lived from 1608 to 1674, wrote a poem called A Hymn on the Morning of Christ's Nativity. And he is talking about the music that the angelic choir sang when they appeared to the shepherds, but in doing so, he compares it to the music that took place at creation. And he says, "Such music as 'tis said before was never made, but when of old the sons of morning sung." There's Job. "While the Creator great his constellations set, and the well-balanced world on hinges hung, and cast the dark foundations deep, and bid the weltering waves their oozy channel keep. Ring out, ye crystal spheres, once bless our human ears, if ye have power to touch our senses so, and let your silver chime move in melodious time, and let the bass of heaven's deep organ blow, and with your ninefold harmony make up full consort to the angelic symphony." There are a couple of ideas there that we need to talk about. When he says, "Ring out, ye crystal spheres," he is alluding to the medieval picture of the world in which the world is the center and it is surrounded by a series of concentric, transparent crystalline spheres, each larger than the one inside of it. And each one of these spheres is turning around the earth. And in each one of these spheres are set the various heavenly bodies. In the outermost and largest sphere, well, the second outermost, are the fixed stars. And those are all the stars that move together. But of course, there are planets that cut across the field of stars and don't behave themselves. And those are each set in their own individual sphere inside. And this accounts for the free movement that they have across the plane of fixed stars. And in the medieval mind, the sun and the moon are also two of these wandering bodies. Like Venus, like Mars, like Jupiter, they have their own spheres, and they too orbit around the Earth. Now, the outermost crystalline sphere has no heavenly body set in it. It is simply called the primum mobile. The primum mobile, or the first mover, because it is the outermost that is moving, and it imparts motion to all the rest. And what is really delightful about this picture of the universe is that God, who resides in the Empyrean, outside of all of these crystalline spheres, is what all of these spheres are trying to get close to. But being spheres, their attempt to move in a straight line results in a circular motion. And so the whole universe is turned by a love for God and a desire to be close to the heavenly throne. The whole universe orbits because it loves God. That's a very exciting idea to me. And that's what he means by "ring out, ye crystal spheres." And that explains, "and with your ninefold harmony," because he's not talking about the nine planets as we know them. Neptune and Pluto, which are not visible to the naked eye, would not have been part of the medieval cosmology. He's talking about sun, moon, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, I'm missing one more. Did I leave out Mars? Mars, that's the one. And so he's talking about those plus the primum mobile plus the sea of fixed stars. Nine altogether for the ninefold harmony. Now, that is the idea of creation with music as its vehicle. There's something else that we saw in Job, and that is the song of the stars themselves once they are created. We saw it in Lewis. As soon as the stars are made, you can hear their silvery, tingling voices singing. Now, in the medieval mind, the various parts of the universe, and particularly the planets and the stars, all have their sounding number, because music is a very, very mathematical phenomenon. So they called this their sounding number, and that is to say that each one of them emits a different pitch in an inaudible cosmic harmony. They knew that it was inaudible. That was not a problem for them, that you can't actually hear the stars. They were not naive about that. C.S. Lewis describes it this way: "The music of the spheres is the only sound which has never for one split second ceased in any part of the universe. With this positive, we have no negative to contrast. Presumably, if it ever did stop, then with terror and dismay, with the dislocation of our whole auditory life, we should feel that the bottom had dropped out of our lives. But it never does. The music which is too familiar to be heard enfolds us day and night and in all ages. You might put it this way. If it seems like a problem to you that you can't actually hear the stars, well, you also can't smell what the inside of your own nose smells like. A blind man who has been blind from birth doesn't know what darkness is because he has never had anything to contrast with his darkness. The music of the spheres has always been ringing in our ears. We have nothing in the medieval mind to contrast it with. That's why we can't hear it. There's also another possible answer to this modernist problem that we would have looking back and saying, what? You can't hear the stars singing. So what does music of the spheres even mean? And that is that music is not essentially something that is audible in the medieval mind. It is essentially something that is mathematical, that is concerted, that is fitted well together, in which all of the parts contribute to the whole. Music is an elegant dance. It is harmonious. And it is the harmoniousness of the cosmos, the harmoniousness of the music of all, the harmoniousness of the movement of all the stars and all the planets, the harmoniousness of the human body, and the harmoniousness of the entire universe that makes it musical. That is why it is a musical phenomenon, not because, oh, I can hear it. In his Harmonies of the World, Johannes Kepler sought to demonstrate that the mathematical ratios of the planetary movements, as apparent to a spectator standing on the sun, could be expressed as pitches of musical scales, and that the concerted movements of all the planets together could be expressed as polyphony. And he writes, "Hence it is no longer a surprise that man, the ape of his creator, should finally have discovered the art of singing polyphonically, which was unknown to the ancients, namely in order that he might play the everlastingness of all created time in some short part of an hour by means of an artistic concord of many voices, and that he might to some extent taste the satisfaction of God the workman with his own works in that very sweet sense of delight elicited from this music which imitates God." You know who else in recent time found this idea very exciting? Olivier Messiaen. Messiaen was very interested to write music, 20th century avant-garde composer in France, very interested to write music that could depict in the short space of an hour the sense of eternity and of a music that never ever finishes. If you really want to sink your teeth into some difficult listening, some challenging listening, listen to Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. And I'm thinking especially of the first movement, because in the first movement, Messiaen has set up these enormous isorhythms. In other words, cycles of events that do not quite line up. One may go for this long, one musical event may go for this amount of time, and the other goes for this amount of time. So they're out of sync. And it takes a certain number of repetitions for them to get back to where they started and to be realigned. And if I'm correct, there is a music theorist who, studying the Quartet for the End of Time, found that some of the isorhythms which Messiaen created would take several thousand years to work their way back to where they started. So it's definitely an attempt to represent eternity, even though the piece itself takes something under an hour to play. Now, the other thing that's interesting to me about this music of the spheres idea is that it's so much bigger than our concept of what music is. Because our concept of music, if I say the word music, the things that we immediately associate with that word are somebody playing a jazz piano, or the music that is getting pumped into the grocery store, or my cousin is studying violin at Juilliard, or my kid brother playing the recorder, or me putting my iPod buds in and listening to something. All of these things are man-made forms of music. And in the medieval mind, they represent only one slice of the music that is available to us. First of all, and I'm taking this from Boethius, the Roman that I mentioned before, a Roman music theorist whose treatise on music dominated medieval thinking for the next 1,000 years. The first category of music, according to Boethius, is musica mundana, the harmony of the spheres, the elements, and the seasons. The second category is musica humana, But it's not what you're thinking. It's not man-made music. Rather, it is the concord of body and soul. The way that your body is itself a concerted instrument in which all of the parts contribute to the whole. The way that your body is harmonious. Finally, there is the least order of music. The musica instrumentalis, the sounds of man-made instruments. So you see that we, with our modernist glasses on, have inherited only one of the three categories of music that the medievals saw, or rather, heard, so to speak. Now, I don't have time to get into C.S. Lewis's The Discarded Image, but I want to pause and recommend that book to you if you're very interested in reading more about the idea of the medieval cosmology and seeing how all of this fit together so elegantly. C.S. Lewis's The Discarded Image is a book that unpacks this in much greater detail and a very easy read. It's not dense, erudite reading. Let's talk about the spirits of the seven planets. There was an idea that each of the seven planets in the medieval universe had its own angelic spirit who was in charge, who ruled that planet. And that each of these seven spirits had a different character. And so I want to read an account of just one of these angelic spirits, just one of these gods with a lowercase g, if you don't mind. This is from C.S. Lewis's book, That Hideous Strength. You may recall, if you've read it before, there's a chapter, The Descent of the Gods, in which the seven spirits of the seven planets are coming down to Earth to help in the battle against the forces of evil. Upstairs in the mansion at St. Anne's, Dr. Ransom and the wizard Merlin are waiting for the seven spirits to descend, and downstairs in the kitchen, the rest of the group, the army of St. Anne's, are all assembled, and they both experience this encounter in different ways. When the spirit of Jupiter, Jove, descends on the house. First of all, in the kitchen. In the kitchen, his coming was felt. No one afterwards knew how it happened, but somehow the kettle was put on. The hot toddy was brewed. Arthur, the only musician among them, was bidden to get out his fiddle. The chairs were pushed back. The floor cleared. They danced. What they danced, no one could remember. It was some round dance, no modern shuffling. It involved beating the floor, clapping of hands, leaping high, and no one while it lasted thought himself or his fellows ridiculous. It may in fact have been some village measure, not ill-suited to the tiled kitchen. The spirit in which they danced it was not so. It seemed to each that the room was filled with kings and queens, that the wildness of their dance expressed heroic energy, and its quieter movements had seized the very spirit behind all noble ceremonies. Upstairs, Dr. Ransom and Merlin experience this when the spirit of Jupiter descends. Upstairs, his mighty beam turned the blue room into a blaze of lights. Before the other angels, a man might sink. Before this, he might die. But if he lived at all, he would laugh. If you had caught one breath of the air that came from him, you would have felt yourself taller than before. Though you were a cripple, your walk would have become stately. Though a beggar, you would have worn your rags magnanimously. Kingship and power and festal pomp and courtesy shot from him as sparks fly from an anvil. The pealing of bells, the blowing of trumpets, the spreading out of banners are means used on earth to make a faint symbol of his quality. It was like a long, sunlit wave, creamy-crested and arched with emerald, that comes on 9 feet tall with roaring and with terror and unquenchable laughter. It was like the first beginning of music in the halls of some king so high and at some festival so solemn that a tremor akin to fear runs through the hearts of the young when they hear it. For this was great Glund Oyarsa, king of kings, through whom the joy of creation principally blows, known to men in old times as Jove. And under that name, by fatal but not inexplicable misprision, confused with his maker. So little did they dream by how many degrees the stair even of created being rises above him. And I want to listen now to a musical depiction of this particular god with a lowercase g, this angelic spirit, the spirit of Jupiter. This is a piece by the composer Gustav Holst, which many of you will know, Jupiter. And if you do know it and would like a fresh way of listening to it, I suggest that you listen to how it is, in fact, an essay on a very small set of notes. Da-da-dum. You'll notice that in the Great Chorale, which is where we'll have to stop about halfway through, da 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 da, they're the basis of the chorale. But you'll hear them in other places. Bum bum bum, ba 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 bum, ba ba bum, ba 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 bum. And even the initial flurry of motion at the beginning, the joyous eruption, is really two sets of strings going da 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 da, very fast. So here we go. Here is Gustav Holst's Jupiter. And now we plunge back into the A' section of it, and I'm going to have to stop it there. You can see that the medievals and the Greeks lived in a world which was literally enchanted. That is to say, it was full of chant or full of song. Song was what drove it, and song is what it constantly gave to God. Love was what drove it as well, because, as I already explained, the crystalline spheres are trying to get close to God, their maker. Now, let's take a step back from this idea, and let's talk about world models, because this is a model of the world. It is a picture of the world, a way of seeing creation, a way of seeing things. And unfortunately, with our modernist glasses, we often fall into the trap of thinking that our world picture is actually the way things are, the way things are, in an absolute sense. And we forget that what we are really talking about is a picture. In other words, we have a model of a solar system in which the sun is at the center and the planets orbit around it. And we think that this is the way things are, and that the medievals were only participating in a bit of fanciful thinking. Or that when we read the book of Job, it's a bit of fanciful poetry. And it really doesn't mean very much other than, well, creation is really lovely, and there's something music-like about it. But there's no real, hard, essential meaning behind these words. Well, what I want to give you now is a condensed version of an argument that C.S. Lewis presents at the end of The Discarded Image, where he talks about different world models or different world pictures. So if you want to read a much more elegant and expanded version of this, check out that book. But here it is in condensed form. Suppose that you had a contour map of terrain where you have all of the altitudes of different valleys and different mountains indicated on it. And you spread it out in front of you, and you can tell from this contour map that, well, this would be a very, very steep trail to hike up. Or if we stood on top of this hill here, we ought to be able to see the lake. It tells you things about reality, but it would be a gross mistake to suppose that reality is actually a bunch of lines on a two-dimensional grid, and that that's the way the world really is. The contour map is a picture. It tells you certain things which are true, but it omits other things. It misses certain things. For example, if you're trying to find an ATM machine, a contour map is no help to you at all. So also, our two pictures of the universe, the modernist picture of the universe and the medieval picture of the universe, both catch different truths about reality. Neither one is reality in some absolute sense. We as human beings, I submit to you, are incapable of apprehending reality absolutely. We always see things through a lens. We always speak in pictures. If you've gone to hear Miss Howe talk about Owen Barfield, I imagine you've already got an earful of this. We speak in metaphors and in pictures. We are incapable of thinking apart from our lenses. So, what we should really be asking is, what are the truths that the Greco-medieval picture of the world catches, and what are the truths that ours catches? Because I suggest to you that the person who is most blessed is the person who is willing through imagination to see the world through different sets of eyes, and thus to stand in the place of many different men and see the world from many different angles. And to prove to you that I don't just want to wind back the clock and go back to the medieval model of seeing things, I'm going to talk first of all about the way that our model is better. Our model is better, for one thing, because it is so much better at making predictions about what is going to happen. In fact, that's one of the big reasons that the old model collapsed. It was because it was getting more and more convoluted trying to keep track of events in the night sky and predict what was going to happen. It had to become too elaborate to be sustainable. Now, thanks to a modernist lens, I can go onto Google and I can have a pretty good idea what the weather is going to be like in 5 days. That's an amazing gift, and it's thanks to the fact that we no longer have a medieval worldview. Also, the medievals denigrated practical music making. Somebody like me who plays an instrument with his hands would have been a much lesser musician than the scholar who understands music in the mind. That is, according to Boethius, the true musician, the one who apprehends music intellectually, because technique is the handmaiden to the intellect in the medieval way of thinking. But I suggest to you that our way of making music is much more sacramental because it has an appreciation for the stuff of which things are made, for the actual sounds that the medievals would have denigrated in favor of the idea. Our way of making music respects the 10 pipes of the organ, the sound waves of the air, the stuff, the things that make up reality. And by extension, I think that we have a better sacramental theology insofar as we affirm the essential goodness of the physical creation. But now let's talk about how the medieval worldview was better. And I think you can already have a sense of how it was better. It was so much more elegant. It was so much simpler and intuitive. When you walk outside, what you see is the stars revolving around the earth. It was intuitive in this way. It was so much more beautiful and so much more exciting. We live in a cosmos that, by comparison, is disenchanted, an essentially lifeless interplay of matter and energy which responds spasmodically to stimuli. Our universe, by comparison to theirs, is a twitching corpse. Contrast it with the medieval universe, which was driven by the motions of love for God, by cosmic song, and which often displays a volition of its own. Also, our notion of music, as I've already explained, is so much narrower than theirs because it's so much more anthropocentric, so much more man-centered. Music is, for us, the sounds that people make. And this may, I suspect, contribute to our way of evaluating beauty in general, that beauty is what I like. It may also be reflected in the prevailing way of listening to music these days. I think that a lot of people these days grow up listening to music as the soundtrack to my life. I listen to music so that it can provide the soundtrack for me, for my life. And that is a way of listening to music that will never give you the gift of being able to step out beyond yourself. You will only find yourself in that kind of music listening. You will only see yourself again and again in a mirror. You will only rediscover what you already know. You will never grow, never learn anything new if that's the only way that you listen to music. And our cosmology is less biblical if it causes us to see God as far removed from his creation and to see creation itself as an essentially inanimate thing. Because as we already saw in the scriptures, God is very, very close to creation and indeed permeates creation and works through his creation. Contrast our view of the universe with the biblical picture. The voice of the Lord is upon the waters. It is the glorious God that maketh the thunder. Our typical way of thinking about creation is that miracles happen because God, so to speak, puts his finger and stirs up the water. But in fact, the medieval, Greco, early Christian, ancient Jewish view of the world was that God is running things all the time, and nothing happens unless by his express will. He makes everything happen. He is the one who is constantly causing our hearts to beat. He has not wound up an enormous clock and stepped back from it and let it run and then only every once in a while jumps in to perform a miracle. He is running things all the time. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera, Deborah sings in her song. The morning stars sang together, "Sing, O heavens." I want to leave you with one last thought in closing. If this is a hard thing for you to take away, the idea of a singing universe, I want to tell you a story about when I was going to a service at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and it was Palm Sunday, and they were going to have a procession from outside the church in the courtyard into the church itself, led by a donkey lined with palms on either side to commemorate Christ's triumphal entry. And all the choristers were waving their palm fronds back and forth. And all the palm fronds were interlacing and pulling apart again. And watching that, something clicked in my brain, and I remembered how Isaiah talks about all the trees of the field shall clap their hands, and realized that the trees of the field must have been clapping their hands when Jesus rode into Jerusalem, because I could see it happening right in front of me while we were commemorating that event. Now, I would never have guessed that trees could actually clap their hands. It would never have occurred to me. So I suggest to you that it is helpful to live into the biblical language, even if you don't yet understand exactly what it means, in the hopes that God will someday allow you to see what it means. Thank you for your attention.